Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans.
$829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Today I have Kat Bao Li and her partner, Tin Wing, an immigration attorney, both of North Carolina. I really appreciate you both coming on to Vietnamese podcast. And before we start, I just want to sort of put this disclaimer there. I am very aware that this could be a political thing. I don't know if it's actually a party issue because I think, and you guys can correct me later if I'm wrong, but Obama deported a lot of people. I think that the articles that you sent me, I read that, you know, it was like felons, not families, you know, was a quote that Obama said. So I think Trump is sort of carrying out policy that's very an American policy that's happening in this day and age. I want to ask first, why should we really care about people who did wrong a long time ago and them being sent to a country that they came from, their parents came from, that they were brought from? Why should we, as Vietnamese Americans, care about these people who are being deported back to their home countries?
So why we should care and why it's broader than what it appears at face value, which is people did wrong, people committed crimes, need to be deported, is we have to take context into consideration. Vietnamese, if we're talking about Vietnamese folks, we came here, our diaspora, your diaspora, my diaspora, Tin's diaspora, came here because of the wars that were happening in Southeast Asia. The context that is even deeper is that when we were resettled in the U.S. and even in other places, my family was resettled in London. You know, we were resettled in neighborhoods and places that were already under-resourced with failing schools, over-policing. And we grew up in a time where there were a lot of policies from the police state that really targeted us and other Black folks, other brown folks in our communities. The war on drugs, the war against gangs, which really created a gang database where I know for me, as a Southeast Asian person in Sacramento growing up, there were a lot of us that were being criminalized, targeted, you know, picked up by police for ditching school. I was one of them. And you were automatically put into a gang database. And that was a police program that then created a criminalization of who you were. As a young person, 15 or 16, you were tried as an adult during that time. So the mistakes that you made growing up, mistakes that everybody makes, you and I, you know, maybe we didn't get caught, but our friends, our peers, people that we went to school with, later on, when you look at that and you draw in the context of what was happening in the U.S., what was happening to our communities, where we were resettled, what other communities were around us, what they were going through at the same time that what we were going through, being criminalized, then you see how this machine works and how, you know, 30 or 40 years later, after my peers and your peers have, you know, gone to jail, served their sentence, but don't have citizenship, they become deportable after they have families, nail shops, you know, work to clean up our bathrooms at our universities. So that is the part, the context that becomes important. And I think when you talk about those elements in the context, in the historical context, then you kind of begin to look at things differently.
When you're dealing with folks that just came over the country as refugees, non-citizens that don't have a lot of English background, or they don't even have the financial means to obtain citizenship. A lot of folks, they think having a green card is okay. They're having a green card, you're good to go. They're not going to mess with you at all. But then, Kat's talking about in the 90s and this era where a lot of folk, refugee kids, they banded together. That was their protection from other groups, you know, and getting in trouble. And then when they're in the criminal justice system, like if they were white, if they had money, there would be no issue. They would get out of it. But because they a lot of them didn't speak English, they didn't know what was going on. They didn't have a lawyer to really explain to them what the effect of pleading guilty or anything is. So 97% of all criminal convictions are just plea bargains. They just say, this is your crime. This is what you do. If you plead guilty, you're going to get out. And it's and a lot of time during this time, they did not explain that later on, this would affect your immigration status. You would be later on picked up by ICE. Later on, you would be deported back home, separated from your family. A lot of folks didn't even know that. So a lot of people who we interface with, a lot of them got in trouble in the 90s and early 2000s, you know what I mean? And throughout. And if they had resources and if they understood English, they would have not had it. But again, this is a system showing you that even if you serve your time, even if you paid your debt to society, it doesn't matter because of your status. And if your parents were able to get your citizenship, let's say they got citizenship when you were under 18, you would have automatically got citizenship. Then you would have served your time and been out and not have to deal with deportation. So it's like a double standard that we're dealing with.
Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
What a nightmare that somebody has to deal with their sort of ignorance many years later, just because they didn't know, just because they really didn't speak English well at the time. And to penalize them many, many years later. And it's hard for, I think, people, Vietnamese Americans who have done very well in society, to fully understand the extent of not punishing people who made mistakes a long time ago. It's just very difficult for our community to understand, like, oh, we should give them another chance.
Some of that is by design also, to be honest, you know. We're both Vietnamese Americans. We both have families where we have really had to spend a lot of time talking about this issue because there is that feeling of like, you know, but we're doing great. And I'm like, no, well, you know what? There are people within our family. If you ask, there's people within your family that may have an order of removal, but are not talking about it. So I think, you know, it's that our community, Vietnamese Americans, it's like a whole spectrum. We're such a diverse group of people, even in terms of how socioeconomically we're doing. But I think that sometimes the loudest part of our community are the ones that are doing good. And then we forget that actually there's a predominant population that is monolingual, that does not have access to legal services. That is, you know, not in the Vietnamese associations, might be coming to the New Year's, but not in the leadership. So there's just a lot of room and work to be done internally to really not add more shame to this issue. So I can share an example personally of growing up. You know, there are people in my own family that have orders of removal. People that if you think about growing up in the U.S. and you think about, oh, you heard about that uncle or that auntie or that cousin that was locked up. Like, those are the people I go back to now, first and foremost. And I want to know their immigration status because I want to know, like, how can em giúp tại vì lúc đó là em nhỏ quá. You know, I couldn't visit you in jail. You know, all these things. We had their pictures up. Mothers crying, like aunties crying. And those are things I remember being 10 and 11, but I didn't know what was going on. And can I forget about that now? Yes, I can. But if you think back at your family and growing up in the diaspora, especially in California, because I was in California at that time and in Orange County, and a lot of crime of survival was on my family with, you know, computer chips or, you know, home invasions, things that were just going on in the community of people trying to survive and bring home more money for their family. You know, I know that there's people in my family now that have come out the shadows with me that talk about their order of removal. But unless we're asking, we tend to hide that. And that is not what I want to replicate a second time in my life. You know, we did that as kids. We had to. We didn't know anything else. But as adults, how do we talk about this? How do we help our siblings, our cousins, our uncles that are now living in limbo and are afraid every day that if they leave their house, they could get picked up by ICE, especially under this administration? And that has happened.
Well, one of the things that I'm really interested about both of you, and I think I want to ask this question because in order for us to develop some compassion, I think having an understanding of both of your lives and why you got into this work sort of kind of will open up some sort of empathy for the rest of us. I sometimes have trouble understanding why people do good, why people care about people who have done bad in the world, and now why do we get a second chance? And I think I'm just speaking out loud and being honest, sort of how a lot of people in our community look. Why do you think both of you have dedicated your lives to this work? What started it? What inspired the journey for both of you to really fight on behalf of people who are in this predicament?
I've been thinking about this, and it's kind of hard to like think about, oh, what was it? But I think like my life story, like I was born and raised in Alaska, in Nome, Alaska, a little town right outside the Arctic Circle. My dad was an Air Force mechanic and left Vietnam like 2 days before the fall. My mom, they met in the U.S., but she was on a boat person, you know, and both ended up in Alaska. And then being in Alaska, we were around a lot of folks, kind of the anti-communist groups in California and the rest of the country. So when Vietnam did open up in 87, my parents went in 88, 89. So when I was a young kid, I was already in Vietnam, seeing the bullet holes and seeing all the different things, a bunch of sick clothes, and just I saw a lot of things as a child going to my family's native land, you know, and then that kind of stuck with me. And what really stuck with me is a lot of the kids, street kids, you know, in Vietnam at that time. If you went back, you saw like people selling lotteries and nanyai and doing all kinds of stuff. And there was a certain kind of like fascination, but not like, I was just like, wow, you're my age, but you're out there doing all this. And I'm in the US and I'm eating cereal and watching cartoons and all these different things. So I could see this contrast. And then when I went to college, I got older and I studied Vietnamese at the university. And then I got an opportunity to go back to Vietnam to study abroad during 9/11. That's when I was in Vietnam, and I did a research project on street kids. And so I was out there under the bridge and in District 1, just interacting with with kids without families or on the streets. And something just really inspired me to really see like the humanity, because a lot of people were not seeing the humanity, because you can go to the fancy restaurant and then see people asking for money and then just totally disregard. But something inside of me was like, I don't know. And then like after college, I thought I wanted to do international NGOs. So I ended up in Hanoi in at CARE International doing work with HIV/AIDS. And that also opened up my eyes, because these are all like in Vietnam, it's like Sa Hoi Đen, you know, like people who are matui users or whatever, getting infected. But these are my friends. These are people that I love to be around. And so it really opened my doors, my eyes. And then after that stint, I actually went to law school. Because I was like, you know what, I don't think this INGO thing is for me. But what can I do to better serve? And then I went to an HBCU, an historically black college university. And I didn't understand it at the time, but it was so important for me to see, like, as in this settler colonial system that built its wealth and built the country around slavery and genocide of indigenous people, and like not giving black folks who are native born in this country first class citizenship, like seeing like being like a student of professors who marched with in the civil rights movement, who did litigation in the civil rights movement, I saw like how like where I need to be. And then a professor, there was one person that I read about, his name's Charles Hamilton Houston, the first legal counsel for the NAACP, who was a black lawyer and was saying that if you're a black lawyer in the 30s, you can either be a parasite on society or a social engineer. And that really hit me hard, because as a lawyer, I'm making money on the police state, like traffic tickets and like people getting deported, all this stuff, like all these things. Or you can just not be a parasite and try to use your skills to really serve and shape society where people can breathe more and live more liberated. You know, and then also the last thing I've always thought about is if during the French period, there were a bunch of Vietnamese people who were the elites who were able to go to school and become lawyers and all that. What did they do? They just kind of kept the system in place. And while our people suffered, and for me, I was like, I'm always going to be that lawyer that will try to put a spike in the spoke to keep, so I don't keep that system of oppression going. What can I do? You know, and so that has always like inspired me to keep the fight.
I think it's a bit of like how I grew up, and then also a lot of luck. And I say luck in the sense that I was given an opportunity to really contextualize like my life experiences through being an ethnic studies major at Berkeley. And so let me go back a bit. You know, I was born and raised in Tottenham, London, which is North London, in a public housing, we call it estate, Broadwater Farm. And then we stayed there. My parents were always trying to come to the US, where my grandparents had resettled after the war, but it took 13 years of building the petition and resources. So I grew up in London. And I also, you know, when we came to Sacramento, I just have had this feeling from a young age that something was wrong with the things that I saw around me. So in London, there was five kids, living in poverty. My mom didn't speak English. My dad was working at that time, mainly in Brixton. And, you know, I just remember instances in my life of being made fun of. We were the only Vietnamese family in North London at that time. Maybe there were two. You know, being walking down the street and little Irish kids or whatever, British, like doing the Iceland thing. And I also remember moments of beauty where people would bring us food and clothes and toys, you know, from the church. And my dad, we didn't spend much time together, me and my dad, but he would take me. I was his friend, you know, to take me to the neighbor on the left and the neighbor on the right, and we distribute like whatever food we have that was going out of date, basically, because they gave us the out of date food. So these moments for me really meant a lot. And then coming to the U.S. and then seeing the injustices of like my community at that time in Sacramento, there were a lot of race wars. You know, it was mainly predominantly people of color where I grew up, but there was race wars at my middle school and my high school, mainly at my middle school, between like black folks and Southeast Asian folks, and that banding of together. And I always basically wanted to make it to college. So I worked really hard in high school, not knowing where it would take me, but it got me to Berkeley. And my first class I took at Berkeley ever the first class as a freshman was African American studies. And that really gave me so much context. Like, I read stuff that, through never reading anything Southeast Asian, it felt so familiar and it gave context to my life. And then I took, you know, ethnic studies and a lot of like Gloria Anzaldúa and a lot of the books I read, Borderlands, just hit home. And then I found my way to Professor Katharia Un's class, which is Southeast Asian community formations. And in there, man, it blew my mind. Like, it just contextualized my life in Sacramento. She talked about like the importance of like these Vietnamese dance, you know, you more non la and you more like nan gai and you more the ribbon dance. I did all of those growing up, and it was a way to get out of my house. And she was like, she just broke it down. And I remember feeling like, wow, validated, but also my experiences matter. And also there are structural policies, laws, and things that have been created in place before I was even born that have created the pathway of my life now and what my parents had to face and what we still struggled with being poor. So all of that adding together, Berkeley was also a great place. I remember my first action against deportation was in 2002, where the Southeast Asian Student Coalition at Berkeley, which is a new formation, you know, really did a protest on campus against Cambodian deportation with signs and everything, marching around for our plaza, and then also did a fundraiser every year entitled We Will Not Be Moved. And things like that really showed me that, you know what, there's much more that I can do. And also my experience is a minority experience at a place like Berkeley. But if I can actually use my voice and use my labor to bring more awareness to this, but also fight it, then my people are better off. And the people that I grew up with that didn't make it to Berkeley, that were way smarter than me, you know, like, you know, those homies, like they, this is for them too. So that was kind of like my journey into then after college, you know, joining an Asian civil rights organization in San Francisco, working on deportation and a number of other grassroots things. And then when I say luck, it's I've had great mentors that have come in, you know, Asian American mentors, Japanese American, like folks that just held my hand through a lot of the stages in my movement life and my professional life.
This next question has nothing to do with our podcast, but I'm just curious. You two are like born to be together. How did you guys meet?
That's a long ass story. Long for this podcast. I don't know if we're born to be.
I'm listening to both of your stories, and the origin stories of both of you are, you know, it's like, it's so, not, it's not similar, but it's like you guys were kind of like molded in this sort of same ethos of protecting the weak in society. And the formation of both of you and how you met is something that I want to know about.
So I'll share this part. Like, I was, after law school, I was lost. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to do immigration. I had taken a study abroad class on immigration law, where I was like, wow. And the professor focused on like crimmigration, like criminal and immigration. And I was like, wow, this is what I'm going to do. This is after Vietnam, going to the school and then going to Mexico, like learning Spanish and all this. I was like, wow, this is what I'm going to do. I ended up at UC Davis for a semester at the immigration law clinic because the professor was the head there. So that kind of established my tie to California. So after I graduated, I didn't have a job lined up or anything. Like, most people go to big firms or whatever, but I was like, I need to go on this immigration deportation route. And the only way I could was actually work for my professor. And I was like an old school apprentice. I lived in his house. I cooked, I cleaned. That's how I got paid. So I can just soak up the law. It was amazing. But then I ended up—
Shout out to Jim.
Jim Smith, UC Davis, founder of the first immigration law clinic in the country. But then I was like, you know what, let me go to let me go to the Bay Area where there's a bunch of Asian American activists. And so I can learn because I'm from the South. We have like activism, but I don't know this Asian American activism. So I was able to go to be in Oakland, and then doing what I do was I was like, you know, I'm a lawyer. I need to like show know your rights information for our community. And so it was a fake drum too at what park do they call it? Clinton Park, Oakland, next to like International Boulevard. And I had printed out this, and this is 2000. So we're in Bush, George Bush time. So George Bush and 9/11 and all of that stuff. So a lot of people in our community with green cards were getting caught in the web, leaving, going to Vietnam and coming back with criminal records. So then you're caught in the web. And so I saw something from the Asian Law Caucus that said, no, before you go. And so it had all this information in Vietnamese. I was like, oh, man. And like, it was like, and before this, I did like a club promotion at one point, you know? So I was like passing out flyers, doing all this stuff. Like, so it was very natural for me. And I was able to talk to people because I also speak Vietnamese, right? And so I pass it out. And then there's this girl here that was at the park. And I found out that she worked at Asian Law Caucus, and it was her document that she had uploaded. And like, I was just like, oh my God. Like,
yeah. Yeah. That was wild. I was like, what's he doing with our organization stuff? I was like,
that is crazy. And it's like meant to be.
Well, it wasn't though. Cause then we just were like, hey, they're like, hey, what's up? And then we didn't talk for like a couple of years. We didn't know each other. So we were just like, I went on with my Bay Area life. He was just doing his thing. And then it wasn't until I moved to Vietnam for a fellowship to work. I was working in Saigon and Hanoi. And then a mutual friend was like, hey, I know that guy. Oh, I was at her house, actually. And I saw a picture of him. I was like, I met him a few years ago. And then, you know, then he started trying to holler at me and stuff like that. And then it took longer.
But wait, you saw his picture, and then where was Tin?
How's it, Charlotte, North Carolina?
She was in Charlotte. I saw his picture. Okay. She had gone to her wedding in Orange County.
Okay, and then how did that connect? How did you connect? Because you saw the picture in Vietnam of Tin, and then so did you go like, can I get his phone number? Can I get his information? Like, how does that work?
She, shout out to Jang, was always trying to hook me up with people, and she was also a Ajit to Tin, so she was always trying to hook him up with people. So she was like, oh, I think she contacted you and was like, Tin, I met Kat, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So then he started to try to chat me up on Google Chat back then.
Yeah, Google Chat.
So, yeah.
Gmail chat.
But then nothing happened for a while. And then
the BP oil spill happened.
And
it's a long story, but then it brings in our people a lot.
Yeah, it brings in a lot of the fights that we basically were, we went out to... you know, respond to things that were happening in the community. And BP oil spill was one. I was back in the U.S. part-time by then. And then we both ended up in NOLA, met again. And then I was on my way to law school. I needed some money, got a short-term gig in Charlotte. We were here again. And then I haven't left since. So it's been a whole...
Wow. Did you guys run into Daniel Nguyen from Sung Kai out during the oil spill?
I think so. From Atlanta?
He was in NOLA at the time. He is the founder of Sung Kai Gin, but he spent 10 years in the Gulf fighting for, you know, Vietnamese Americans that were affected by the oil spill at the time.
We probably did. We were there with a group of like 20 or 30 attorneys. I was the non-attorney there that came in from mainly California.
Yeah,
but we had local connections there. So we probably did meet him or definitely know someone who knows him. But I can't remember off the top of my head. There's a lot of Daniel Nguyen's too.
Yeah. So you both live a very, I think... correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not sure how to really categorize this, but it's a strong pro bono ethos. Your work requires working with people who don't really have money. So how do you both live in the world, make a living, while serving the underserved?
So I personally don't draw that line between like underserved people with money and then us. Like for us, I think it doesn't feel like that. I don't know how else to say that. Like it doesn't feel like that in terms of education. I think there is sometimes a difference with like folks that we're fighting for in the Vietnamese community that have orders of removal. But there's plenty of folks that have college degrees also and actually, you know, have more means than us sometimes. So, you know, I have been in the nonprofit world since I graduated college and I had hella loans. So I've had to make decisions. You know, when my friends are off working in banks or going to law school and joining firms or whatever, I made a lot of decisions along the way that kept me close to what I'm passionate about. So this work might not pay a lot in money. And Tim being an attorney for the people is also like a misconception that he, you know, every attorney is just fucking rich as hell. But like, we have more than enough than for what we need in this life. We're not about stacking more at the expense of things that we really care about. So for me, for a long time before meeting Tin, you know, it was sometimes I had hard times where it's just hard to pay rent or I never had furniture in my apartment in Oakland. Like, you know, and things that it was okay. I never thought about it as like, woe is me. I thought about it's like, you know what? This is for right now and I'm gonna stick to what I love and what I want to do, even if I don't know the next step. When you major in ethnic studies, a lot of people are like, what you gonna do next? You just don't know the next step. So you kind of get used to it, at least me. So there's a lot of folks along the way that have been, you know, comrades of mine through that journey at Berkeley, through post-Berkeley, that might not be in the same work that I'm doing now, but certainly are always looking out like, Kat, how can I support? Or I know who to go to because they were activists with me as students. So you don't have to be in this to continue at the level that Kat is or Tin is. Like, we need folks everywhere. We need folks that are, you know, like, own the foot, a restaurant. We need folks who are nail techs. We need folks who are now, like, in firms and are lawyers. And they're the only Vietnamese person there. And they have to hide how Vietnamese they are. Like, we need all those folks to be able to come in and support this work. So I don't see it as like pro bono. I think that's a term that's used a lot for attorneys that are doing work for free. We both do a lot of work inside and outside of the organizations that we might be affiliated with. And that's who we are in our families too. Like if someone needs help reading something, they know they can come to me. You know, if someone needs to go to the Medicaid office, generally what got me good at this work was because I was doing it anyway, you know, like, so, that's kind of how I look at these things. It's not like pro bono for the underserved. Could we have made decisions in our life that were going to put us in mainstream corporate America? Absolutely. I think we all can make those decisions, but that was not something that was for us or for me.
And
I wouldn't thrive there. I'd probably get fired.
Yeah. And for me, having like my own law firm, where I'm like the boss and of myself and like my staff and all that, like there's a lot of freedom. So when I first started out, I would take off 3-4 days just to travel down to Alabama where they were detaining a bunch of Vietnamese folks and Southeast Asian folks. And then like spend time there to visit my client and then come back and drive back. But then that's like 2 days, 2-3 days of work that I don't have, you know.
Yeah.
And if I was in like a big firm, they'd be like, no, you know, like, what are you doing? And so I've been able to really be able to choose the kind of cases that I would like to work on pro bono. But sometimes a lot of those cases choose me. You know, I don't really have the options because a lot of folks like that need the kind of litigation to help them get free, it costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of like energy. And I know that if I'm not doing it, then what are the other nonprofits doing it? And are there other like private attorneys that would take on the case? And there isn't, you know, unfortunately we know that. And so that's why it's, I see it, but I also know that this was a model during the civil rights movement, when a lot of Black attorneys, they weren't going to big firms or whatever. They kind of had to set up their own law firm in their own community, serving their own community and getting paid that way, but then also being the sword and being the shield for their community. You know what I mean? And so I kind of grew up learning the law within that environment. And so it just made a lot of sense being in the South and being in a Vietnamese community that didn't have a lawyer. I was the first Vietnamese attorney in Charlotte. And so just, you know, this is what I have to do.
I want to call out for those people who cannot see the video right now, but Tin is wearing a t-shirt, a very amusing.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Amusing t-shirt, he said.
I'm like, as I said, amusing t-shirt, you guys like dropped the camera. That was weird. That was funny.
That was the ancestors.
The ancestors, hang on. Do not pay attention to what's happening on the video right now. He's wearing a t-shirt that says no Trump, which means fuck Trump. And I think that I want to bring the attention to the question that I've had, that Obama deported a lot of people. Like, it was like the record level of like deportations. Trump is doing, he's probably trying to outdo Obama. But now my question is this the policy of the United States at that level where it's by design that we just want to kick out felons and criminals that, you know, return them back to where they come from? So my question is this a really a political thing, or is it just the way America does business?
That's a good question.
Excellent question.
And I just want to like say that it isn't Obama, it isn't Trump. Like Trump, Obama, Biden, all are building upon something that was built earlier. And I want to like talk about Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton in 1996 triangulated, moved further to the right than Congress to pass two terrible immigration laws that really expanded the net of deportation, making grounds that weren't deportable now deportable, and catching a lot of people in our community in the net and facing deportation. And then from Clinton, you have George Bush that after 9/11, increase that security apparatus for detaining more people and for catching more people in the deportation system. And so after Bush, you had Obama doing the same.
Can I rewind you here? Why did Clinton go so hard?
Well,
I think
all of this is rooted in white supremacy.
Yeah.
If we go back. Right? Like the Chinese exclusion laws, like all of this stuff, like the internment of Japanese, you know, we're not strangers to the United States picking on Asian. Right. And so this country, this is native land. These are Europeans coming here, the Spanish, the English, the French, the Dutch coming here and taking land, like how the French took the Vietnamese land. You know, and then setting up their colonies and taking our resources and using labor. That's exactly what this country is. But then all of a sudden, they don't want to give the same rights and the same privileges to non-whites, to the Chinese that were building the railroads, to the Mexicans that they took the land in California and the missions and all of that stuff. And And so they have a legacy of the United States saying, we want these Europeans, these white people to come here, like in the movie Far and Away. Like they can come here and just take land, you know, just on a force and go pick whatever land that's native land, right? And then the Chinese people and other people who are laboring for the United States empire and the economy, well, we don't want you here. We're actually going to deport you. And that's with Asians. But then after World War II, during World War II, you had all these laborers that had to leave as soldiers, right? So there was a labor shortage. What did they do? They went to Mexico to get all these laborers and the braceros. And then when the war ended and all these soldiers came back, they're like, oh, we have a surplus of laborers. So what are we going to do? We're going to criminalize marijuana, make all these different like reasons so that we can pick up and deport Mexicans with their families who are U.S. citizens or permanent resident. It doesn't matter, just as long as you're not white. And so that's what happened in the 50s. And so we're seeing like this whole idea of like what this country means for these folks. And it doesn't look like us. It's not just truly not a melting pot. That's what they want us to believe. But the true nature of this country, and I really saw it, was when we sent a delegation, or we were part of a delegation from Charlotte to go to Standing Rock and to fight with indigenous people against the pipeline. And so it made sense to me, because I was like, wait, the United States from the East Coast was expanding west in Manifest Destiny and taking native land in the Great Plains at the same time when the French were coming into Vietnam and taking our land. So it's just like
plantations.
And they set up rubber plantations and they did all these stuff. And I seen the pictures of like a white French woman passing out coins to our people. And we're just children looking for the coins, or we're begging. And so it just hit me. It's like, you know what? Like, this system is still in place. It never ended. And so when the U.S. entered the fray in Vietnam, you know, supporting the French recolonization of Vietnam there from World War II until 1950, the Minh Phu, like, and then the U.S. taking over, like, all of it is part of the same conquest, the same colonial conquest. And because of that conquest, that's why we're here. That's why our community's here. But then now they're saying, well, we don't want you here anymore because you committed a crime. But wait, we committed a crime. It wouldn't have been a crime if you actually resourced us and gave us the education, gave us access to healthcare, access to legal services, all these things that other people get, but not us. And so that is the root of it. And so Bill Clinton, George Bush, Obama, Biden, Trump, they're just building on it. And Trump is doing what other presidents have done, but he's just doing it in a very loud and aggressive way, you know what I mean? Trying to shock and awe what he's doing, you know?
And yeah, on top of that, I don't think that we can ignore the promises that Trump has made to be the biggest deporter in the history of the U.S., or what happened in 2017 when he did take office specifically to Vietnamese folks and Southeast Asian folks. But for this podcast, is, you know, we're talking about Viet folks. So in 2017, when he took office, we saw the rounding up of 95 Vietnamese folks from across the country, predominantly those with old criminal convictions in it. So like 10, 20, 30 years ago, and being detained in Stuart, where the Vietnamese government flew in and interviewed each person to evaluate if they could have, you know, travel documents. And we gathered 9 people from the South, attorneys, Vietnamese community members, aunties, us, Black activists, and we went out there and we were able to really interview and get to know a lot of the brothers at Stuart Detention Center. Prior to that, 100 Cambodian folks had been rounded up under the Trump administration. And that's just talking about Southeast Asian folks. You know, there was the Muslim ban. There was, you know, ICE doing its thing on the streets of Charlotte, grabbing kids at bus stops.
school bus stops, things you don't hear about, going to apartments, raiding chicken poultry factories, like things that are happening in the South. This is what we know happened in 2017 when Trump took office. This is what we reacted to. This is what we had to organize about. This is where so many organizations actually now have grown and developed and been created because of what we saw under the Trump administration. So we would be silly to not think about what's coming next month with these promises.
In 2017, when you went to Stewart Detention Center and there was 95 brothers there, how successful, or was it a mission of yours to stop the deportation? Was it something that you're able to do, or was it just a meet and greet and kind of interview everybody? It wasn't really to stop the deportation. Like, how did that work out?
It's always to stop the deportation. But as community organizers, if we're only looking at one case as a victory or not, then we're missing the picture. It's to stop the deportation of these folks who are there, but to amplify what's going on. Like, did you know what was going on then? You know, like, did other VIT folks know? So we did a lot of, as much as we could with the limited media resources, we did a lot of Facebook Lives. We spread the information between a national network of folks that fight against deportation. But like I said, success can be measured in many different ways. Were there cases that were won and people released? Yes. Were there cases of folks that are now in Vietnam that I still keep in touch with and Tin does? Yes. You know, was the issue of Southeast Asian Vietnamese deportation amplified during that time in ways that people listened and different VIT entities around the country, PIVOT, VADN, whatever it was, paid attention and has planted seeds? Yes. But again, I think that as an organizer, I always try to push folks to look beyond a case. Like, are we fighting? People always talk about policies and advocacy. And I'll give you one example. When I was in San Francisco, like, a lot of our work was at that time politically was to change the laws that had changed in 96 that took away prosecutorial discretion. So people with orders of removal could no longer see a judge and plead and actually have their day in court, what people say. So in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, it was about reinstating that because that was taken away in 1996, right? But then since then, I've moved to the South. And I know that the rates of deportation that judges decide out here is so high compared to San Francisco. So our fight can't just be in the courts. It can't just be with policies. It has to be with the way that we see ourselves. We're not felons. That's a definition that the state has created. You know, the state decided when to over-police us. The state decided on which sibling they're going to, you know, give that sentence to. So we also have to work within the community to envision something so beyond the system. Because as Tin said, the system is not brand new. It's been built from the gate with the intention of othering, ruling folks out. So even if we win the case and win this as VIT folks, it won't be long before the state finds another group to criminalize and deport. So our work really has to be about all of us or none of us. And we have to face our casework and our policy work with that lens. Because if not, we're just fighting piecemeal. But at the same time, I do want to say it's important, for me at least, to always fight for each family. Like, we can't just be like, oh, let's wait for everybody to get this policy and we'll all be safe. No, it's important. If your family was going through this, you would want me to fight for you. So it's important to fight and get as many folks free as possible, but with the mindset of all of us or none of us.
You know, there's two ironies that I want to bring up, and they're kind of not related, but I don't want to forget them, so I need to bring them both up. The first irony is I personally know somebody who has orders to be deported, but is so afraid to talk to his mom about the deportation because she voted for Trump or his family voted for Trump. So it's like many people are in this weird situation where they love their families, but the families voted for Trump and they have orders to be shipped out. So it's like that irony cannot be lost on our community. Number one, the second irony is a lot of us go back to Vietnam and enjoy the hell out of our trips annually. We love going back. We love using our American dollars to party and have a great time. And a lot of us are thinking, well, if you get forced to go back and you get deported, your life is going to be great. You don't have to live in America.
Interesting.
And you get to party and you get to XYZ. I would love for you both to clear up these misconceptions about people who get deported back to Vietnam and why it's different than people with money or in good standing going back to Vietnam and using their money and then coming back to the U.S. and living a regular life. You know, so there's these two ironies that I can't stop thinking about.
Well, we'll start on the second one, right?
Yeah. Also excellent, excellent question.
Yeah, excellent. And I think like a lot of folks don't realize that when they're deported back, like they're Vietnamese citizens. So the first thing is they have to get their Vietnamese identity card, right? There's challenges with getting that, especially if you're non-kin. If you're kin, it's a little bit easier. But if you're like from the highlands, Montagnard, you have to pay a shitload of money, corruption money, just to get like just a document to show that you're a Vietnamese citizen and normal, right? And because of your status as somebody who's been deported, there's kind of like a scarlet letter on you,
yeah,
trying to get like a job or trying to get just being normal in the community. People are like, why are you here? You're here because you've been deported, because maybe you're an American spy or something like that. You know what I mean? Or you're a criminal. And so it isn't normal.
It's not partying.
Yeah, you're not over there. People are just trying to stop. We've met people who are now elder, like older uncles now, who are 60-something working construction for $150 a month.
If they're lucky. Actually, a lot of folks.
And then other people, when we were back in 2 years ago in April and May during the heat wave, and then they can't afford to live anywhere but in a non-air-conditioned apartment.
Not even apartment.
And for like
a slum.
Yeah, like a slum. And they've just recently been deported. And so life back there, it's not all what you think it is.
But true. When we, as Vietnamese Americans, when we go back for a month, at the end of the month, ain't nobody got no more money. Because we spend it all. So it's not like that these folks are living that 1 month life. Like these folks in Vietnam, you get aged out of work real quick. Saigon is not a place that is sustainable for anyone over 45. There's actually things where they prefer younger workers. So our elders over there are oftentimes Noida or trying to get seeds to farms. So we fundraise for that. A lot of the young folks, you know, why the documentation Tin mentioned is important, because you don't get no services if without that documentation. You can't go to work without that documentation. In addition, like you have to also remember that this is a life sentence. You can never come back to the U.S. where you've lived 20, 30 years, where your wife is, where your kids are, where your grandkids are, where your elderly parents are. So just being in somebody's paradise and seeing people come in and out, especially your own peers, they come in, they come out, and then you're stuck there. Can you imagine the level of mental health issues that come up from that? Like so many of the siblings that we are our family now, we support them and we try to fundraise every year. You know, I just did a fundraiser to give everyone $100 this holiday season. We didn't reach it. But, you know, last year we reached it. We blew out the water. That's the stuff that they look forward to, convening for a holiday dinner every year. Because other than that, they don't see each other. They're all in different locations. And as Tin mentioned, when they land, there is no support there for them. They pretty much land, are unshackled. And if you have family, they can come pick you up. But if not, you're just released into Saigon. Many of them don't. They've asked for a map, a backpack, for medicine, a pair of shoes. So all of this information is going to come out, Kenneth, because we did a short survey on this and the needs to amplify, and we'll be moving in that direction in 2025. But there's so many needs out there, and it's not what you think. Being a prisoner in paradise is not paradise at all, especially when you're away from everything that you've built and you've known. And that's not to mention a lot of the Montagnard folks, the indigenous folks from Vietnam, and a lot of the younger Viet folks that are there are just having to learn Vietnamese. Like, when I get on the phone with them, they're like, English, please, G, because my Vietnamese is just barely getting there. So, you know, these are folks where America has been their home, and they've grown up here. So it really is a life sentence to be back. I think the first question is a really complex question in our community, and you probably have some, you know, responses yourself, but there is a lot of voting against our interests in our community. I think, you know, deportation is one of the issues that I'm super glad you're talking about, because it's the issue of our generation. It's not about the different communists, anti-communists, but Min, Hoakla, you know, Zizan or whatever. It's an issue that came out of our diaspora being refugees here, an issue that has been an issue for far too long. We've been 50 years in this country, you know, so it's an issue of our generation. And hence you see a disconnect sometimes between the elders who are voting maybe on a different platform, a platform where they feel it represents their issues of like which party is less communist, you know, or less likely to go shake hands with the president or whatever. Like, you know, that's their issue. But our issue is what we're facing day to day here. And sometimes you see that there being a disconnect. I think the more that we're not talking about it on Vietnamese podcasts, in Vietnamese media, you know, the more that we're not talking about it with our parents, that, you know, the more that we're not coming out of the shadows with it, the larger the disconnect becomes. I love seeing that, like, now Vietnamese associations, especially in California, are taking on the issue of deportation. I'm like, damn, like, it's not either party. This is like an issue about our community and how to keep us safe. And I love that the younger folks from UCLA, or see them, I'd be watching, you know, because I'm from California too. So I watch the seeds sprout, and I'm like, that's it. Like, the younger folks have to be able to take on this issue without the shame of, you know, the elders, like, oh, you only need to talk about this issue and it's about communism, anti-communism. We can talk about that too. We're complex human beings, but let's talk about the issues that are affecting Vietnamese Americans, Southeast Asian Americans now, and how that connects with other communities and their liberation. That's what floats my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a multiracial setting. That's going to speak to me, you know? So we have to allow for that. We have to understand a lot of the pain that the elders have, but not let that hold us back from taking charge with what our issues are of today.
And I think that issue is the Vietnam War never ended, right? The Vietnam War wasn't just between the North and the South, and then the April 30th, 1975, and all that. It's like what Kat was saying. It's just an issue for the diaspora, within the diaspora. And so when you're dealing with people being locked up, it's kind of similar to people going to the labor camps and being separated from your family. And why were you in the labor camp? Because of political issues, right? And then these folks right here, a lot of folks I know didn't even commit the crime, don't even know. They just said, their lawyer said, plead guilty.
Right.
Just plead guilty and you'll be out soon. And so, you know, that's the thing. And so you're the entire time you're separated from your family. You don't know what's going on. And then later on, you now, because you're swept up in this political and diplomatic issue between the U.S. and Vietnam, now you're in the middle of being arrested and deported back to Vietnam because you're being swept up in that kind of flow again. And so I just want to remind folks that we're still in the middle of that war, like the war that brought us here, and that war that brought us so much suffering and so many tears for family members. It never ended. And because of family members getting arrested, getting deported, there's so many tears being shed right now. So many children that are not with their parents because of this issue, because of who they're not the desired ones in the United States. And so it's just like, if we could take a step back and just look at us as from this one diaspora, like Vietnam War, and we had to come because of that, and see like the consequences of that, like, whoa, that's what the root of it. It's not like now, we're American. We're American because we pay our taxes. We do all this stuff, and that we're not those people. But no, we're the same people. It's just that they're not targeting us now. But we can very easily be targeted later. You know what I mean? It's not like, and that's like right now they're saying, well, we're going to start doing these denaturalizations. You know what I mean? Think about all the people you know that got naturalized and maybe withheld some information or did whatever, you know what I mean? Because they were embarrassed. But now that becomes a ground for them trying to take your citizenship. And so you think you might be safe, but no, honey, no, bruh. The future might be compromised because of the new policies in place. And so you're never quite safe.
So today we went over maybe 10% of my questions. We didn't even get into the kind of logistics that I wanted to get into, you know, if there's a potential for somebody who is, you know, in the situation to come to you, I want to know how all that works, but I don't think, you know, because that opens up another hour or two of another. So I'm wondering if we can revisit this perhaps in March, April, when sort of like that train, the Trump train, is moving along with the deportations, and there's more to kind of update our audience about this whole situation. And then we can get into sort of the roles of what you all do and what, you know, what the clients can expect and how the logistics happen. I mean, and I want to hear some real life cases of what you have seen since, you know, 2017 to today, yeah. The whole timeline that we couldn't get to, because, you know, I wanted to hear the motivations and set the backdrop for this situation. And I think for the next few months, we'll keep an eye on what's going on. And we can start here today. This is the last day of the year and it's about to get real. And I just wanted to, you know, really sit down with you both before the year ended. So I appreciate both of you for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kenneth.
I appreciate
you covering this. If I could just make an appeal, you know, we had a $2,000 fundraiser that we're sending folks that have been deported $100 each for the holidays. They're away from their families. It means a lot. We made $830 off as of today. So we have a little bit more to go. Like I said, last year, we were able to blow it out of the water in 3 days. This year, at least for North Carolina and Hurricane Helene and all of the appeals and donations that people have been making for so many different causes, I think it's a little bit short, but we hope, you know, that people in this podcast or if you have a network of folks can help us raise that. And 100% goes straight to the siblings in Vietnam who...
Where can people donate?
There's a GoFundMe on the SEAC Village Facebook page. So that's SEAC Village. And I can also send you the link. We're really trying to reach UK so that everyone can get $100 each.
That would be great. If you can send a link and we'll leave it in the description in the podcast. And then, you know, we'll revisit all of this hopefully at the second quarter of the year.
And could I add something real quick? Because this is coming like 20 days, like we're recording 21 days before Trump takes office, right? And then what we saw in 2017 was when first came into office, he really wanted to shock and awe. And that's when our community got swept up.
Yeah.
And so right now, if you're hearing this and if you have an order of removal, like I know for certain that you're going to be targeted. That's what they do. Those are the low hanging fruit because you're checking in every year. ICE knows where you live. ICE has your phone number, all that stuff. And so please, if you haven't talked to a lawyer about some ways of exploring whether to reopen your case or pardon or any kind of avenues for relief, or if there's any, please go see an attorney now. And also please remember that when they start doing their raids, that you don't have to open up the door.
Yeah.
You don't have to open the door for anybody. Like most ICE officers, they're not going to have a judicial warrant signed by a judge. So you don't have to open the door. And so be mindful of that. Tell everybody,
your kids,
your family member, and just be vigilant, because now's the time for us to be vigilant and to protect ourselves and protect our families, because we know what's going to happen.
And in addition,
you
know, you can reach out to us. Organizations are going to link you up with attorneys that are tried and true and trusted. So if you link up with us, even if you're not in the South, if you're in Arizona, if you're whatever, you know, we can also put you in contact with an organization that does Southeast Asian deportation work as a first point.
But what if I just wanted to leave the country and hide out for a few years and not Vietnam, but just go to Mexico, go to another?
Well, you can. But the issue is you don't have any, when you have an order of removal, you don't have any more documents. The only thing that you get is a work permit. And the only reason why you get that work permit is because you have to check in with ICE. If you check in with ICE and they show that you signed in, that's the evidence you need to get your work permit. But you're not going to be able to get any kind of a passport or anything. But that's the thing, is if you get a passport, then that's when ICE will say, now you have the travel document, so you can't be deported to Vietnam. So you're pretty much in a gray area. You're in limbo. You can't go to Canada. You can't go to Mexico. You can't even go back to Vietnam, even if you wanted to, because only the Vietnamese government can issue that document through the diplomatic channels with ICE.
So you should not go out of the country. You should not leave. You should just stay put.
You should stay put. And if you even have a green card and you had some run-ins with the law, don't go. You stay in, because once you leave and come back, that's like them looking at your whole history again. And if you have a conviction that they think is something that is deportable or inadmissible, meaning they won't let you in, then that's when they're going to start taking your green card and putting you in deportation. So the smartest thing is, actually, if you're eligible for citizenship, apply for citizenship. And
we can help you with that.
You know, yeah. So that's why there's things that we can do to protect you and your family members now, before it's too late. Because a lot of times when people are detained, they're in detention. That's when I'm trying to do things. But we're under a tight time constraint.
Different options.
But right now, when you're out in the open, then we can actually do things. You know what I mean? So don't procrastinate. And I think that's what happened last time, was people didn't know like what would happen, and until it was too late, until they started body snatching. You know what I mean? And then that's when the whole community was like, oh my God, what to do? And that's when all the attorneys are also kind of in that shock mode too. But right now we have a little bit of in between that we can actually maybe just look into your case. You know what I mean? And that's what I advise folks right now.
Yeah, it's important to get this information out earlier.
Kat and Thin, thank you both so much. And we will be talking soon, probably sooner than March. I think we need to revisit this probably a few weeks after the inauguration.
Thank you for doing this, Kenneth.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye. Say bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.